sitting here with David Aiken at TechDad 2010. David is a technical evangelist for Windows Azure. David, welcome. Good to see you.
Hey, good to see you, Bob.
Now, you're doing a session here at TechEd that talks about building an advanced Windows Azure service. So
That's right. Before
we get into sort of the details of that, can you just help us understand what's the difference between an application and a service?
Yeah, so it's quite simple. So a service is something that you have to run versus an application, which is something your developers are going to build and throw over the fence. And the IT operations get hold of that and maybe you install it, maybe you're an ISV and you're selling that software. But you kind of forget about it. Running it is not your business. When you move into the service realm, you've now got the problem of people want 24/7 access to it. You've got to deal with capacity planning. You've got to deal with doing live upgrades. So once you start your service, you can never take it down unless you've got really understanding customers. You know? So if you look at products like Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, very good uptime on all of those services. And whenever we're doing upgrades, it's quite a complicated procedure to keep people running through that. And Windows Azure gives you a platform to build these types of applications. But when you were running it as a service, perhaps multi-tenancy comes into it, you've got a lot of customers using the same code base running in the cloud, you've now got to think about, well, how do I do an upgrade? I want to change something, but I've only got one place I can go to and do some sort of upgrade or some sort of swap,
right,
things like that. So there's a lot more, there's a lot of different things to think about.
Interesting. So now I know within Azure we can build different types of components. We can you know, build a web application with a user interface, a worker, a process with like a background thread, and services, you know, web services and things of that type. And there's storage. All those different pieces that you can put together in your application, are there particular architectural patterns that lend themselves to pulling all those capabilities together into a service?
Absolutely. And a lot of the patterns work around the principle of trying to keep your service up and running 24/7. There's some guarantees that we have in the data center about SLA, so you know, 99.9% of the time you'll be able to hit your service and access storage and all those kind of fun things. And all those details are on the website. It might be more nines than I said. But there's 100% guarantee that at some point we'll take some running piece of your application and turn it off. It might be because we've spun it up somewhere else because we have to patch the OS that's underneath. Or maybe that there's going to be a hardware failure and you've failed and we bring you up somewhere else. So it's 100% guarantee that you will get restarted. And you have no control over this. There's no, hey, Dave, we'd like to restart your service. Can we do that? Well, you know, Tuesday afternoon's a good time because I haven't got many users. It just happens.
Right.
There's no control. So you've got to build your application or your service in a way that can handle failure, can handle scale, and there's some patterns that have been around for years, you know, old mainframe patterns of using queues and things that you can apply to services running in Azure today. And a great example is decoupling your application using queues. So you have a web role and a worker role and you want to do some work, you pop a message in a queue, and then a worker pulls the message from the queue, does the work, you know, done.
Right.
If it fails, then the message gets put back in the queue. If you don't delete the message, message comes back in the queue, another worker can come along and do that job. And it's a great way to scale out the application as well. And as an example in my talk, I may, assuming the internet still works tomorrow, is run a Monte Carlo simulation that we have. And we use about 70 instances. And we have queues between everything. We have a lot of queues between everything to scale it up. But basically, we put a job in there, and we put a whole bunch of messages in some queues, and then the 50 or 70 workers pull the messages out, and that's how we kind of scale it. However many instances you have running, they're just pulling messages from the queues. So you want to add more compute power, just add more compute power, they're all pulling from the queues. So it's kind of like a little bit of a load balancer kind of thing you can do with that. And again, when a worker fails, messages are still in the queue, so something else can pick it up. So that's one great pattern everybody should be looking at as decoupling their application and thinking about how they can scale different pieces of the application at potentially different times and how to monitor on Spotify.
All right, so I know how to do that. I know how to solve those types of problems, take a decoupled approach, a message-oriented approach to my architecture. Let's say I've done that. Is there anything else I need to know about Azure? Like what kind of workloads is Azure optimized for?
So when you're building for the cloud, it gives you some real advantages when you're building applications and services. And I think the flexibility of being able to scale up and scale down is something that you really have to think about. And it gives you some real new ways of putting together services. And there's a few patterns that we've talked about so far. And one is the obvious burst pattern where your graph's like this and there's a big spike. And that could be a predictable spike or an unpredictable spike. But let's say it's month end and you do a lot of invoice generation or something like that. Most of the time that compute power in your data center is sitting around for the other 28 days of the month doing nothing.
Right.
And then those 2 days of the month when all the invoices get generated and get sent out, the machines are doing something. Well, in the cloud, guess what? 28 days of the month, you've got probably one thing running just to be ticking over in case somebody needs to do something ad hoc. And then just before you want to do your big invoice runs, you turn the dial up. And instead of having 10 servers, like you might have in your data center now to do that job, you can say, well, I only pay for those 10 servers when I actually use them, so actually I could get 20 servers instead. And it would be cheaper than having 10 for the whole month.
Better use of your resources.
Absolutely. So you've got this on-demand kind of computing, and come invoice day, you can turn the dial up, have 100 running, and instead of taking 2 days, you can do your invoices in 3 hours. And perhaps that gives you an advantage over your competitors. Some other scenarios that we're seeing is predictable growth, but you want to start off, you don't want to invest in a whole bunch of hardware and infrastructure so that you can grow. You want to just turn the dial up as you get more users. And a great example is things like social networking, Facebook applications, that kind of thing. Where you start off and it's you and your 8 friends on Facebook are using the app, and that's, day one's 8 users, day two's 22 users, day three's 48 users. Week one is 10,000 users,
right,
and then week two is 20 million users. And you didn't have to go out in the beginning and maybe buy all this infrastructure and figure out how to do all the load balancing and everything like that. You just have to build your application in a way you can scale using the pieces of Windows Azure that you need.
Yeah, great approach for a start.
And take it up. Yeah, and it's low risk. If at the end of week one you've still got 8 users, you won't spend $500,000 on hardware to go there. And,
right.
And you can try things out, run them for a few weeks and throw them away. And that's another great thing I like to do is the disposable data center model of, hey, look, I need 20 servers because I'm doing a demo at TechEd. So I go and spin up a huge app, make sure it's all running, do the demo, and I throw it all away. And you just can't do that outside of the cloud kind of thing.
Right.
The other one we see is, and I get, every once in a while I get a phone call from some panicked Microsoft guy out in the wild. Oh, this website's going to be featured on Oprah. We've been told to expect 200 million views. Can we put it on Azure? Because we need to really turn the dial up, handle that workload, and then turn it back off again.
Right.
So that's another one where you've got this semi-predictable spike of big traffic.
The Oprah effect.
Yes, in more ways than one, I'm sure. So that's some things to kind of think about. And it doesn't have to be your entire application that uses any one of those models. It can be like, oh, the invoicing is just a batch job. We'll just deploy the servers when we need to do that particular piece of work. Or we can, look at our capacity, look at our performance and handling over a period of a month, and then really tune how many instances or how many servers you've got running. So Mondays are great. We have 4 because everybody, after the weekend, doing lots of work. Tuesday, a little bit less. Wednesday, not so many. Friday, everybody's kind of, and you can really be really dynamic about that.
So a combination of some strategic planning, intelligent approach to how you say, oh, I've got this, these applications in my current data center. Some aspects of those make sense to run in the cloud with this tuning approach.
Yeah.
Decoupling, a proper decoupled architecture for dealing with failure. It's a great approach. Now, Azure also has different kinds of storage. I think a lot of folks want to understand, you know, how do they go about think about whether they should use SQL, Azure, relational store, or the other types of storage that Azure provides, like tables and blobs.
I think historically, you, as a developer, it's, you know, we use SQL Server. You will store all your data in SQL Server. So we end up storing images in there, movies in there, PDFs in there, Word documents in there, as well as some relational data. And because that's the store, you will use the store or you will go and find a job elsewhere. And in the cloud, because you're just going to pay for how you use the storage, that the decision to use just SQL Azure is kind of not a great one. You can really now go, well, actually, this piece of data is relational. How I'm going to use the data will require me to do joins, to do complex queries. It makes sense to put them in SQL Azure.
Right.
This auditing data that I have, I just need to keep it in case the auditors come around, then we're going to go and dig it up. I've got to keep the data for like 7 years. Traditionally, you're going to put that in SQL, and it's kind of pointless because it probably doesn't have any indexes on it. You query it once every 3 years or something like that. It really is just there for some regulatory requirement or something like that.
Right.
Go put that in table storage. Even if the useful part of that is kept in SQL Azure, you can still just put your audit trail in table storage. Pay your 15 cents a gigabyte. Pay for your insert kind of charge on there. And if somebody comes along and says, oh, we need you to pull back this audit data from, you know, 3 years ago, you kind of like get one of the devs to write the query there and then in C Sharp or VB or whatever and run it. And if it takes, hey, it's going to take 4 days to run because we're going over like, you know, 3 terabytes of raw data that doesn't have any indexes, nobody cares, right? It's the auditors. They're going to be there a while. So again, you're making that choice. Blob storage, great place to put blobs. I mean, it's the file system in the cloud. You can plug that into the CDN. So if you want to serve out content worldwide and have it go fast, then turning on the CDN is just a tick box, quite frankly, and a different URL. And again, you know, you've got now all these choices to do it. And I would even argue that, you know, I might put this data in table storage, but actually it might make more sense in blob storage because of how you're consuming it on the client. And we've got an example of this where every 15 seconds we want to update kind of a news, like a Twitter news kind of feed. And there's maybe 300,000 clients going to be hitting this service all at the same time within a very short period of time. And we're like, oh, how many compute instances are we going to need to run this and handle the query? And then we kind of went, hang on a minute, why don't we just put an XML file in blob storage? And the SolarLink client, instead of making a call into the service then queries the database, caches the results in memory, sends the thing back. You know, maybe the cache lives for 5 seconds, but you know, there's a whole bunch of issues you've got to solve there. Why don't we just have a worker that every 5 seconds puts the answer in a blob, and then all the clients can just read it from the CDN? And you know what? No compute. We're just now playing blob storage and bandwidth instead of having 20, 30 compute instances.
So it's a very fast solution.
Very fast solution. So again, you can start thinking a little bit, I hate saying thinking outside of the box, but thinking outside of the box and how you can use this storage in different ways.
Well, it's logical. It makes sense. I mean, it's simply a matter of, you know, as you described it, looking at what the scenario is, the kind of data it is, even though it might traditionally have gone in a relational database. It just at that moment, you have to say it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
Let's actually think through it and say, does it belong there or not?
Yeah.
And you have the other choices, which are very scalable and have some other nice capabilities.
And the more stubborn you are about, I'm not doing that way because everybody else does, the more fun you'll have using the storage in different ways, and you'll discover some really powerful pieces in the platform that, you know, are there on purpose, but it's going to take a little bit of time to think about how can I use this in different ways.
Right. Awesome. David, this has been great. Now, where would someone go to get started with Azure?
You just need to do a search for the Windows Azure Platform Training Kit. That's a mouthful. But that's got all the hands-on labs and a whole bunch of PowerPoints and links to samples and demos and things. You can download that. That will get you started. It has some quite advanced topics in it as well for deployment and inter-role communication and that kind of thing. So that's a great place to start.
Excellent. David, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.